Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
So I've been enjoying the adventures of Herbie Cohen, the world's greatest negotiator. It's by his son, Rich Cohen, the author of Pee-wee's Confessions of a Hockey Parent, a book that I had no reason to like because my kid didn't play hockey and we all skate on our ankles. But it was just such a true telling of what it is like in the competitive world of youth sports and how the parents behave and how you ache for your kid and you want to see him succeed. And if you can relate to that at all, then read that book. It's called Pee-wee's Confessions of a Hockey Parent. But now, Rich, you've turned your considerable talents on your dad.
Well, actually, Pee-wee's, I started with a quote from my dad. My father wrote this book when I was 12 called You Can Negotiate Anything, How to Get What You Want, which became this monstrous bestseller when I was a kid. And he has a philosophy about win-win negotiation. I believe he actually coined the term.
Win-win.
Yeah, and he says the secret to living a good life is to care, but not that much.
I underlined that when I read the book this week, and there's another great line from your dad. You wrote, "The key to life is care, but not that much. Even a cursory study of your dad's behavior will show a man in constant state of overcaring." You Can Negotiate Anything, you wrote, was a self-help book, and as anyone who has spent time around the authors of such books can tell you, those who write self-help are those most in need of self-help. Their work is a literary version of whistling past the graveyard, talking to themselves in the dark. I love that sentence. And then you write, Herbie's favorite aphorism defines his behavior more accurately than anything he's ever said about caring. If you're walking on thin ice, you might as well dance.
Yeah. Well, that's my father. I mean, he would say all this stuff about approaching life like a game, and his whole thing is you shouldn't negotiate for other yourself because you care too much. But this was a guy who would decide that he was overweight and wanted to lose weight, and he would just stop eating for 2 months. He used to walk up into downtown Glencoe just to visit the cakes like they were convicts in prison, you know, just to say hello, knowing he couldn't eat them. So it was a lot of overcaring and a lot of crazy behavior, and it was like, there's a line in the movie Barton Fink where they say, Lipnick has taken an interest. If my father got interested in something you were doing, that could end up being a bit of a disaster.
Well, this is a tangent, so let's just go there since you brought it up. There's also a line or a scene in the movie Glengarry Glen Ross, which is attributed to your dad. Here's a little clip from that.
Have I got your attention now? Good. Because we're adding a little something to this month's sales contest. As you all know, first prize is a Cadillac Eldorado. Anybody want to see second prize? Second prize, a set of steak knives. Third prize is you're fired. You get the picture?
Right.
Now, how does your dad relate to that story?
Well, my father, he became this sort of very famous negotiator. He worked on the START talks. He worked for the Reagan administration. And David Mamet was in Chicago, and he was working on Glengarry Glen Ross. He knew about my father, and he sent him the play, early version of the play, sort of for what I call a verisimilitude read. You know, does this sound right? And my father loved it. My mother hated it because of all the cursing. My brother loved it. My sister hated it because of all the cursing. And my father had one suggestion, which is, I don't remember what the original prize was, but it wasn't steak knives. Because my father used to tell the story. He started and learned, came out of Brooklyn. Then at night, he worked for Allstate Insurance, which is how he ended up eventually in Chicago as a claims adjuster. And he talked about a claims adjuster contest in the early 60s where the first price, in that case, I think, was steak knives. It and was. The second price is you don't get fired. You know, so he said, change it to steak knives. So that's sort of like a little, like my father is kind of like a Zelig-like figure in that he enters all these other people's lives and you see little evidence of him everywhere. So, but it's the story of sort of his coming of age.
He didn't go to business school to be some sort of business savvy guru about how to negotiate things. Where did he get that talent?
It's some of it's just born in his personality. Grew up in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. Grew up in a neighborhood that he used to, a neighborhood in Bensonhurst he used to say was 49% Jewish, 50% Italian, 1% other. And he was involved in all these different relationships. And he would tell you that where he first learned to negotiate or realized he had a skill was when he was a kid, another kid took a dog hostage and said he wasn't going to release the dog unless the owner of the dog, this very pretty girl, went to a dance with him. And my father became involved in getting this, and that's where he learned hostage negotiation. He grew up with Larry King and Sandy Koufax and all these guys, and he was constantly getting them into a lot of trouble in school, and Larry said getting him in just so he could get him out. So it was sort of dealing with, he's always the thing about dealing with authority, and his other big expression, which is power is based upon perception. Even if you don't got it, you got it if you think you got it. Basically, if you think you have it, even if you don't have it. That's it. So that was always his thing about dealing with people more powerful than him.
That's how he got onto stage with Al Gore, right? At the DNC, he just says, hey, we'll go up and talk to Al Gore. And then I think I'm recollecting the anecdote correctly. He just kind of came up to some Secret Service guys or some people working the door, and he said, how's things going? And he talked like he knew what was going on, and then said, okay, good job. And then he just walked straight ahead into the scene.
Right. Well, his thing was, Larry said, you can't get in because there's so much security before the Democratic convention. My father said, okay, I'll see you there. And he went up, and he just shows up on stage. And I heard from another reporter who saw it, he just walked up with a notebook and started asking the head of security questions about... Yeah. And the guy just thought he was his boss.
But your dad's maybe greatest story, I don't know, you be the judge, but one of the most famous stories is the story Larry King told in his book first, and you relate, and it's the same story. And when I read it in Larry King's book, I thought, this can't be true. And even if it's not, I don't care, it's such a good story. But the Mappo story, right?
Right.
Talk about negotiating with an authority. We could spend 15 minutes telling the story. Can you give us the abridged version of it? But take your time, because this is amazing.
Well, I should say that before the story was in Larry's book, Larry used to tell it on the radio.
Yeah.
And I was a little, he had a show was on from Central Time, 10 to 4 in the morning. And when I was a kid, I would hear Larry telling stories about my father on the radio, and it was, you know, amazing. And my father told the same story in the same voices. So they had these friends, they were in a gang, Larry and my father, called the Warriors Street Club. And they had guys in it like named Hoo-Ha. He was called Hoo-Ha because late one night somebody asked him a question. He said, who? And they repeated, he said, huh? Wasn't like the smartest guy. Inky, Bucko, Sheppo. And Larry was called Zeke, the Creek, the mouthpiece, because he wanted to be on the radio. And my dad claims he was called Hansomo because he was so good looking. That's what he's saying. So the story was, they had a friend named Mappo. And one day they went to school, first day of ninth grade, which was junior high in New York then, to pick him up for school. And Mappo wasn't there. His house was closed. And his cousin was there that said, Mappo has tuberculosis. They called him Mappo because his hair was like a mop. His real name was Gil Mermelstein. And he was going to go to the school and get his school records transferred to his new school or tutor in Arizona where he was getting treatment. And my dad said, you don't have to do that. We'll do it for you.
This is your dad volunteering to do
that. Yeah, at age 14. And they're walking in, my dad, Larry, and this guy named Brazi Abadi. My dad said, you guys, you know, I got a great way to make $20 and we can go to Coney Island and have a great time. And they said, what? He said, we won't tell him Mappo's got tuberculosis. We'll tell him Mappo died. And then we will raise money for his funeral wreath. And they went into school and they did that. And they raised a lot of money for his funeral wreath.
They went to the principal, the teacher's classrooms, and said Mappo died, and they collected money from the
They
kids.
Went to Mappo. Their extent of research of the school principal was to call Mappo's house, find out the number was disconnected, realize, oh, yeah, he must have died, write deceased on his card.
Wow.
And they collected the money. They went to every classroom collecting money, and then they forgot all about it. Larry's whole thing is, won't we get in trouble? My dad's like, by the time Mappo gets back, we're going to be in high school. We're out of this guy's jurisdiction. He won't be able to do anything to us.
They're in eighth grade in this.
They're in ninth grade. Then their junior high went through ninth grade.
Got it.
So they went through their year, and then in the spring, as they get a call to the principal's office, and they think they're in big trouble. My dad's like, I'm going to take care of it. This is always the thing. Always the thing with my father, you feel like there's always a way, there's always a solution, the problem can always be solved. Gives you a lot of confidence growing up. And he said, don't worry about it. And the principal was, they weren't in trouble. The principal said, we're going to start an award every year for students who've done community service. And it's going to be called the Gil Mermelstein Memorial Award. That's Mappo. And the first winner are you, Larry, and Brazi for raising this money for your friend. So they're freaking out. They're going to be a big assembly. The parents are going to be there. And my dad said, don't worry, it's even better. We're not going to get an award, and by the and then we're going to graduate. So they have this huge assembly. Their parents are there. There's like 2,000 kids in this room, this auditorium in Brooklyn. And as Larry always said, in the most remarkable recovery in tuberculosis history, Mappo returned to school that day. And he goes into the school. The school's empty because everyone's in the assembly, but he's very nervous. Where is everybody? He goes into the front office. They say they're all in an assembly. Mappo has this choice where he's going to the assembly. He could go through the quiet side doors or in through the big front doors. He goes into the big front doors. They clang. The kids look back. They see Mappo.
At his memorial assembly.
As my dad said, Mappo's not the smartest person in the world, but you don't want your he knew you don't want your name next to the word memorial. It means you're dead.
Yeah.
Well. And the laughter, because he said kids knew who my dad was. They knew who Larry was. They knew what they'd done. The laughter spread from the back of the room all the way up to the front until the principal, who had no real idea who Mappo was, put on his glasses, looked up and saw him. And my dad, trying to salvage the situation, stood up and yelled through cupped hands, go home, Mappo. You're dead. You're dead. And Mappo turned and ran home. And the story is my dad, Larry, and Brazzi were going to be expelled. They were in huge trouble. They got called in the principal's office. And he screamed at my father, Larry, and Brazzi explained they'd never play sports again. They'd never go to school again. Their lives were ruined. And at the end of it, and Larry's crying and Brazzi's crying. And my dad said, you're right. What we did is terrible. We should never have done it. And we're in big trouble. But think about your own situation. You're in even bigger trouble. I mean, we're three incorrigibles. We came in and told you a kid's dead and you called his house and wrote deceased on a card? And that's it? Yeah, we're not going to school again. You're never going to work in New York again. And in the end, the principal decided, let's just forget the whole thing ever happened.
So your dad, at the age of 14, negotiated that.
Right, but that's his thing. His thing is, he always quoted Arthur Miller, to understand the price, you have to understand the player. This is childhood wisdom, which is understand, it's like radical empathy. Put yourself in that person's position and see the world how it looks. He was able to see how the world looked to the principal, and it didn't look good.
And that's just one short story. In The Adventures of Herbie Cohen, the world's greatest negotiator, is told by his son Rich. He will be signing his book at the bookstall in Winnetka at 6:30 this evening. Rich Cohen's book is the story of his father, The Adventures of Herbie Cohen. Herb Cohen, the world's greatest negotiator. How did your life change when your dad wrote that book? Because he was a guy in the Army. He served time in Korea. He came back and in the insurance business, rose through the ranks. So he always, as you tell, knew his way with words. But then he writes this book. He wasn't a well-known author.
No.
He was a bit of a celebrity in Chicago. He was on Channel 7 with a regular twice-a-week feature, et cetera. But then all of a sudden, he's this international best-selling business guru. How did your life change when that happened?
Well, people started to look at him as a guru, and people started to call him and look to him for answers to things that I knew nobody could answer, you know, but he would try. So my father, when somebody would ask him to sign a book, I've been a writer for a long time, sign a book, you write your name, and you hand the book over. That's how Larry did it. My father would start his signing by beginning, congratulations, you have made a wise purchase that already shows you are going to be a good negotiator. So he spent way too much of his time. Basically, I said, you know, if you got him on the phone, he would talk to you as long as you need. So suddenly there was all this pressure on him to sort of be kind of a guru. And what he was is a kind of a Brooklyn street guy. And one of the things he did when we moved to Illinois before I was born, first to Libertyville, my mother tried to blend. She's from Flatbush. She hated her accent. She hated the way she talked. My father became an extreme version of himself.
Yeah.
And the joke is when people would ask him where he was from, because his accent was very thick, he would say, me, I'm from Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Well, he told your mom that, don't worry, Libertyville has a lot of Jews because, she says, how do you know that? He says, because they got a Chinese restaurant.
Right.
There's a Chinese restaurant here. There's got to be Jews.
The only town with a Chinese restaurant and
no Jews. Yeah, your luck. Her luck. But did you guys get a fancy house then? You were living comfortably anyway by then, I suppose.
Huh? No, I mean, actually, my father, when I was a kid, I was admiring a fancy car. And he said, stupid, waste of money, just if it needs where you get you to go. And then he actually lived by that. He never was very ostentatious in anything that he bought. And to this day, he's kind of ruined some of life for me because I saw this really cool two-seater car zipping by me a couple days ago. And I thought, boy, that's a really cool car. I'd like to own a car like that. And I heard a voice say, that's a stupid car. Waste of money. Can't have a two-seater. You got four kids.
But if your dad was street smart and was able to parlay that into not only a successful career, but he helped a lot of people, how does that, though, get him in the Reagan administration? How does Jimmy Carter reach out to him? Don't they see that this isn't an internationally studied diplomat? It's just a guy with street smarts from New York.
Well, first of all, that's one of the things he realized and taught me, which is everybody's just some street guy from New York. There's no everything. Everybody's basically full of crap. And that's what he'd say when I'd get nervous about things, which is 98% of the people in the world don't know what they're doing. So you'll be fine. Okay, don't judge yourself based on where you're, like, look at who's around you. They're idiots. You're fine. So basically, he started running these. He worked for Sears. He was very effective in training people and in negotiating, and they started loaning him out to other companies. And ultimately, he wound up running training courses for the FBI and CIA. And when the Iran hostage crisis happened, they said, we think we know a guy who can figure out how to deal with this, and they called him in. And that was the beginning for him. And after that, he worked for several presidential administrations. And his whole thing about the Iranians was basically Carter was too nice. And the Iranians were trying to get as high of a price for the hostages as they could. And when he advised Reagan, he said, basically, you should act like a lunatic. Because then it's going to become deal with Carter, this nice guy from Georgia, or deal with this cowboy guy who's spinning his guns around and says he's going to blow everybody up. So that was always, it was always from the street, which is basically you want to give people a choice and guide them in their behavior.
Not necessarily to go there, but you wonder if Donald Trump kept some of our adversaries at bay for that very reason. They knew he damn well might do it, whatever that is.
Yeah, which is you don't know. You want to put a little uncertainty in the other person's head. Like, we don't know what's going to happen. We can't. The cost of this might be more than it's worth doing.
Yeah.
Sometimes you think that with Putin, which is he thought he knew the cost. He was wrong. You know, but if he had a little clearer idea before what the cost would be, he might not have done it, and then this could have been avoided.
Maybe you should take up your dad's tack and negotiate for countries or politicians or something like that.
I'm from Glencoe, went to high school in Winnetka. My father used to say, when I played him in basketball, you're just a soft kid from the hills. And I'd say, there's no hills anywhere around here. He'd go, you get the point. You're a soft kid from the hills.
No, you're not. We got to go. How's your son's hockey team doing?
Well, we're getting ready for the next season. He's going to play for the Connecticut Junior Rangers. We're very, very excited. And I think this is the year he's going to break through into Connor McDavid territory.
Is your son got a college or professional career playing hockey? You've told many stories about it in your previous books.
I've made him realistic about the facts that professional hockey's probably not, maybe college hockey. It's funny, when he was in junior high or in grade school, they had to fill out what they wanted to do in the future. And the girl listed above him said, she wanted to be a social activist. That was her long-term career goal. And right next to her is my son, who said FBI agent. And I thought, they're going to probably meet again down the road.
Read this book. It's really fun. The Adventures of Herb Cohn. And there's a lot of truths in there. The world's greatest negotiator. Rich Cohn, his son's the author. He wrote Pee-wee's Confessions of a Hockey Parent, among other things. That's the last book of yours I read and we talked about. So keep writing, man. It's nice to visit
with
you.
Yeah, great to see you again.
Hey, by the way, have they made a movie about your dad? There's just one good movie scene after another in this thing.
Yeah, De Niro's made for it.
Has the rights been optioned?
We've been talking about it.
I'm glad to hear it.